to Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by Community Radio WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill and at WERU.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. On today's episode, we depart from our customary format to join all the guests of the show into one far-ranging discussion with Living the Writer's Life in Coastal Maine. Linda Buckmaster, Elizabeth Garber, Shanna Compton, and Catherine Schmidt will introduce themselves, treat us to a sample of their work, and illuminate the world of writing and becoming a writer through their own experiences. Welcome to Creative Maine, all of you. I am doing a slightly different way of doing things here, a different template, if you will. And today I have an entire group. I have four guests at once. We're going to be talking about living the writer's life in coastal Maine. As my guests, I have Linda Buckmaster, who is a poet and fiction writer from Belfast. I have Elizabeth Garber, also a poet and fiction writer, and she also lives in Belfast. Shanna Compton is a visual artist and poet in Blue Hill, Maine, and she is the author of a number of books. And Catherine Schmidt, author of several books having to do with nonfiction. Do you fictionalize them? We'll be talking about that. So I'm going to go around in this case and have each person introduce themselves, talk a little bit about their work, and then we're going to hear a short sample of writing from each of them. Let's start with you, Linda. Introduce yourself and talk a little bit about who you are, how you got to this point, and what you're going to read for us.
Okay. Well, thank you for having us. I think this will be kind of fun. We'll see what happens with it. So I have been writing seriously for probably about 25 years. And my most recent book, which is a collection of writings from that last 25 years, a retrospective, and I'll be reading a couple pieces from that. Mm-hmm. I work as a poet, but also as I'm working on some fiction and also nonfiction. And I really work a lot. My books tend to be hybrid in terms of they're not one single genre, which can make them hard to get. They don't know how to shelve them at the at the bookstores kind of problem. And the reason I tend to do that is because somehow the material seems to suggest what kind of genre or form it needs to be in. So I've been in Waldo County for over 50 years, started as one of the back to landers in the 70s, and here I am now.
Elizabeth Garber, tell us a little bit about you and how you came to be where you are.
So I arrived in Waldo County 40 years ago, and I was sort of the second wave of back to landers. And there's something in this community that really encourages creativity. And I just started writing poetry really regularly, and there were lots of events where people could read, and I just got braver and brought myself out and read. And after about 20 years, I shifted over to writing memoir. And I've written two memoirs about One is about growing up as an architect's daughter in the 60s, and the other was about living on a square rig sailing ship when I was 17 and being held hostage in Panama.
Oh, my word.
So I've written a variety. I realized I started writing poetry about very specific, tiny little moments, and I kept expanding. And then I got to stories that were way bigger than I could do in poetry, so I shifted to nonfiction.
Shanna, let's talk to you next. Shanna is in Blue Hill. Tell us about how you got where you are.
I'm probably the most recent transplant to Maine out of this group. I haven't been here too long, about 5 years, I think, permanently. Mm-hmm. Before that, I think that the first time we visited Blue Hill was in 2003, so about 20 years ago. And I kept trying to figure out how to get here permanently. And it was a little bit difficult to work out. Waited for my life circumstances to be right before I could move to Maine. So I'm where I want to be now. I was in New York for a long time before that, and also in the suburbs of Philadelphia on the border between New Jersey and Pennsylvania on the Delaware River. As I think you said in your intro, I am a poet primarily and a printmaker and a painter. So I do both visual art and writing. And those two sort of practices are very overlapping for me. My most recent book is a book of collages. So it's primarily a visual book, but it has a long essay and two poems in the back. So kind of like Linda said, sort of hybrid. Sometimes they don't know where to put that one in the bookshelf either. And I've also worked in publishing off and on in various capacities, including running a small press called Bloof Books. And I publish other poets, and I make handmade, hand-printed lino-cut covers for the chapbooks that I hand-sew. And we also publish traditional paperbacks. So I'm doing all that in Maine now.
All the creativity. Well, we'll mm-hmm. talk about the publishing aspect of things a little bit later. Catherine, welcome. Tell us a little bit about you. You're in Bangor.
I am in Bangor, and I have been here for 25 years. I came to Maine to go to graduate school at the university. I actually have a background in science, so a master's degree in ecology and environmental science, but I wanted to write the whole time. And so just through a series of fortunate events, worked as a science writer for the Maine Sea Grant College program. So that enabled me to experience the whole coast of Maine and write about it. And at the same time, I was also doing some freelance journalism and reporting for various outlets, wrote some books, as you said, and as other people have mentioned, I think that my books are sort of science, environment, nature, but also a lot of environmental history. And they are all sort of based in Maine and about locations in Maine. So it's sometimes not clear where my books are on the shelf either. And I just, in keeping with the creative spirit of the show and my fellow guests, I also write poetry and sort of creative nonfiction.
Yes, a group of genre-defying women. I love it.
Let's sounds like taste. That could be a good program sometime.
Yes, defying the genres. I love it. Do you think we could all get a taste of some of your writing and your different styles? Now, maybe we can go around the group and have each of you do a short reading. You just introduce the reading, what it's from, and then go for it. Linda, let's start with you, since we'll just go around in the same order, perhaps.
Okay, so this is from my latest book, which is called Journey Waters, Poems, Prose, and Places. And it is a retrospective of some material I've done in the past. And a lot of my writing in the last couple of decades has been influenced or sort of respond to the traveling I've done a lot of traveling, so that I could go to Monte Alban, Oaxaca in my 20s and then go again 30 years later. So that's where this poem comes from. Hymn, Monte Alban, Oaxaca. I remember the bees. 30 years ago, I was at this place, and I remember the bees in tents even then, with their noisy work, swarming us, making a life from this dry landscape, the moment of flowering theirs. A mere 2,500 years earlier, humans built here to worship over a wide ocean of bare mountains, leaving what we call ruins, gods forgotten, yet deeply remembered. And the bees, how many years for them the sweet nectar of their praise-making, and before that, the hard packed earth singing.
Okay, yeah. That was beautiful. Elizabeth.
I thought, since one of the things that we do in Maine is we wait the long, excruciating wait for spring. So I thought, even though this poem is 20 years old, I read it every spring in some place. And it's about the lilac's return in Maine. So it's called Take This Vow. The first warm day when the lilacs release their scent, stop going where you thought you were going. Take that first extravagant blossom of lilac between both your hands like your lover's face, drawing in the long, slow pull of that soft scent. Turn away from downtown and head down tree-lined streets searching. Find the double-headed purple bloom's thick, luscious scent. The shy, delicate white lilac reaches over the fence, waiting for you to draw down to your face the pale, thin scent. Find the old-fashioned lilac sprawling along the foundations of the old farmhouses. Spread out your arms and sink into the warm fullness wrapping around you. This is bliss. This is spring. A beginner again. There you go. And that's from my collection, Listening Inside the Dance, A Life in Maine Infused with Tango, with bilingual poems about going to Buenos Aires with my daughter 20 years ago.
Oh, my. Well, it's a very timely poem, given that it's, what is it? It's March 23rd or something, and it's snowing. That's beautiful. The lilacs haven't yet budded in my yard. So I'll think of that poem when they do. Shanna, what do you have?
I will continue the spring through line. After Elizabeth, I've got a poem from my latest book called Deep Whoosh, which is the visual book of collages. And the only thing I need to say about that is I'm hard of hearing and use hearing aids and assistive tech. I have a genetic hearing loss so as I started using assistive tech to consume media, I began reading closed captions, and I became super fascinated by the sound effects and nonverbal captions when you're watching something. So I like the way they're visually represented on the screen. And I also started thinking a lot about how listening for me is partially reading, because, you know, I'm always having to read between the lines. And because I'm a verbal person as well as a visual person, I want every single word that I can get. So they became very important to me. I collected a bunch of the captions and started writing poems and making visual art using some of those closed captions. So this one is called Rousing Chorus. And in the books, both the visuals in the collages and in the poems, the nonverbal captions are represented inside parentheses, just as they would be on the screen if you have them on while you're watching a film. Rousing Chorus. Sometimes we know the end before we begin. We get a chance to steel ourselves against or soften into our disappointments. We spotted a million budding elements today, but tomorrow expect one last hard freeze. Let it be kind and final. Tonight, no foxes come yipping through the valley, though we went out into the field after dark to seek them, and the cloud-ragged full-on moon. Let it merely sweeten the emerging green.
It makes the whoosh make sense now.
The deep whoosh. Yeah, it's a sound effect you often hear in an ominous moment. You know, ooh.
That brings up a question I want to ask you all, but I'll wait, having to do with reading with your eyes versus listening to books. It's a question that occurs to me quite often. But Catherine, in Bangor, so what do you have for us?
So I'm going to read just a little bit from The President's Salmon, Restoring the King of Fish and Its Home Waters, which was published by Downey's Books in 2015. And this book is an environmental history of the Penobscot River and a natural history of the Atlantic salmon told through the presidential salmon tradition. Do you know about the presidential salmon tradition, Adina?
Tell us.
Okay. So for about 80 years, there was a tradition in the Penobscot River of fly fishermen catching Atlantic salmon, so wild sea-run Atlantic salmon that used to run up this river in the tens, hundreds of thousands. As they migrated upriver about this time of year, April was the beginning of salmon fishing season, and anglers would spread out in the section of river between Bangor, Brewer, and up through Veazey and Eddington and fly fish for Atlantic salmon. And the Penobscot was world famous for its Atlantic salmon fishing. And in 1912, one of those anglers decided to give his fish to the President of the United States. And that began a tradition that continued for about 80 years. So you can read about the tradition in the President's Salmon. And here's just a little bit about these first fish rituals, which can be found wherever salmon live. On the west coast of North America, salmon are immortal beings. A fisherman selected, blessed, and purified by the tribal leader catches the first salmon, which is then carefully prepared, cooked, and shared. The head is pointed upriver to show the salmon's spirit the way home. The bones are carefully cleaned and returned to the river so the salmon can reconstitute itself and continue its journey. The Ainu people of Hokkaido, Japan, regard the first salmon of the year as a sacred messenger of the divine. The site of London's Westminster Abbey is rooted in salmon fishing. Salmon fisheries were valuable properties in Great Britain. Annual gifts of salmon were frequently among the benefactions bestowed upon monasteries by pious donors. In Gloucester, England, fishermen gave 1,000 salmon each year to the Lord of the Manor. Knights celebrating a jousting victory called for a dish of salmon, which was cooked in wine and brought by pages on a pewter platter to the sound of trumpets. Between ancient and modern times, traditions evolved, but the essential meaning of the first fish has not changed. Returning the fish to the water, eating the fish in celebration, throwing back the remains, gifting the fish, all of the rituals show respect and honor to the sea as a source of life. The presidential salmon custom maintained this legacy of seasonal celebration while also bestowing honor upon a political leader, echoing the historic status of fresh salmon at the feasts of rulers and kings. Having rare and extravagant foods on the table was an expression of power, a declaration of the special qualities that set rulers and nobles and their actions above the common people.
Well, that's fascinating. You've taught us all something today. I had not known about the presidential fish. Thank you. Well, these are beautiful, and each expresses your very own voice. So I guess this brings me to the question, how did each of you get started writing for publication? And what was your breakthrough experience? How did the dam breach and the waters flow for you? Let's start with Linda.
Well, I thought of this question because I'm doing some retrospection of my own life and career, but also because a lot of times readers, listeners, people who want to write just, you know, thinks it comes out of nowhere, or, you know, or how did you actually, where was your breakthrough, right? And it wasn't necessarily a big Hollywood kind of extravaganza here. I was thinking I had two, but I think this is the one. So a bunch of years ago, well, it must have been over 20, the Belfast Library did a major reconstruction of their building. In fact, it made it almost twice as much. And that went on for a long time and lots of fundraising and all that kind of stuff. So they decided to have an event, you know, to celebrate having this at the library. And one of the board members knew something that I was doing, what I was doing at the time. And I was just I didn't really have any publications, but I was just really working my writing time and and writing poetry. And this person knew a little bit what it was about and suggested that we need a poem at this event. and I have just the person to do it. So I did write a commemorative poem. I know Elizabeth has done some too, which is an interesting kind of work. So I go to the day of the event, and there's the table with the name tags for the people who are participating. And, you know, they say something like so-and-so treasurer, you know, so-and-so, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm looking and I find mine and it says Linda Buckmaster, poet. And it was that moment truly where I thought, oh, I guess I'm a poet. In fact, in this case, I am the poet. And I, you know, obviously it was not something that was publicized widely that this was Linda Buckmaster's breakthrough, because the breakthrough, of course, was mostly in myself starting to claim that identity and living a life that, you know, was more and more centered around my working. So that was my big breakthrough.
Cool. Elizabeth, how about you? What was your moment, defining moment, if
you will? My defining moment, because I had been writing for years and I had all these friends who would send off poems to poetry journals and they would get turned down most of the time. And I thought, I don't read poetry journals from the other side of the country. I want people around here to read my work. So I kept thinking about I might do something someday, but I was turning 50 and the Left Bank Books had just opened in Searsport for the first time. These three women had started the bookstore and I walked around the bookstore and looked at it all. And I thought, if they can do this, I can bring out a book. And they said, well, if you do that, you can have your book release here. So I finalized my document. I found a designer and a printer, and then I had to figure out how to order ISBN numbers, and I could buy one or I could buy 10. And I thought, I'll buy 10. And I had to give myself on the form, it said, what's the name of your press? And it was like, the name of my press. I'm a press. So I named it the Illuminated Sea Press. And in a couple of months from that defining moment at the bookstore, I brought out my book and had my book release, and I ended up selling 1,000 copies in the first year. And that inspired other poets to go, I want to bring out a book. How do you do it? And I said, all right, here's the kit. Here's the team I'm working with. Here's how I do it. I sold my ISBN numbers at cost. And the only requirements was it had to be an accomplished writer who'd been working a long time. But it had to be a beautiful book. And then we started doing readings together. And quite a number of poets brought their books out. And then other people want it, and it's like, start your own press. Keep it going.
Wow. So not only did you publish your own book, but you started to publish others' books and be an inspiration for them and a catalyst. That's fantastic. Shanna?
Again, like Elizabeth, I think that publishing bug can bite you and infect you for the rest of your life. My breakthrough moment when I realized I was a writer or wanted to be a writer was very young, and it's going to sound silly. I know that Linda has heard this story before. I think I told it at the Belfast Poetry Festival. I was 10 years old. I was in a class. We had to do some poetry writing exercises from a book by Kenneth Coke. And he had basically you read a bunch of poems like the William Blake, the Tiger Burning Bright, and a couple of other models. And then we wrote our own poems based on these models. And I wrote a poem about a sailboat. I'd never been on a sailboat. I'm not sure I'd ever even seen one. I lived in Texas and very landlocked at the time. But in my imagination, I was on a sailboat and there were flowers and ladybugs and all kinds of beautiful things. And the class made a little booklet, and seeing the poem that I had written, the very first one I ever wrote in this little, and it wasn't, it was just a little chapbook stapled on yellow paper that made it real in a way that I thought was exciting. And we sold them as a fundraiser for the school to our friends and family. And we didn't do a reading. We were, too little to handle that. but something about my work being in between the covers of a book, even that little paper book, was very special to me. And basically from that moment on, I never stopped making books. As a kid, I just did them with my own work. And then as I got into college, I started working on the the literary magazine. And then eventually, like Elizabeth, I bought some ISBNs and started publishing other people's poetry. And I still do that today. I also worked in publishing for a long time, as I mentioned, and realized that the big publishers, working for a division at Random House, wasn't where I wanted to be. I like this small, intimate experience of being directly involved with a writer, opening the book and seeing their work in those pages. And that feeling is really special to me. So it's still part of what motivates me to not only be a writer, but to help other people publish their work as well.
And when you say you make a book, you literally make it.
I literally make it. I also work as a book designer for a bunch of other small presses. So I do, you know, interior and cover design for a dozen presses right now. But the ones for Bloof, I physically make the books. I took letterpress typesetting. I don't do that anymore because I don't have a setup here. But the insides are digital and the covers are hand printed. I carve them in lino cut or wood cut and hand print and we do 150 of each of those. So again, it's very small. I like these small, intimate situations where the books are going almost exclusively to people who actually know the writer. There's something just really special about that space for me. And I find being able to spend all that hands-on time with someone's work to be really enriching and exciting to do.
You're very intimate with the work, and it's in German, in opera terms, Wagner used to call it a Gesamtkunstwerk, a total artwork.
Mm. Yes.
And that's what you've got. That's incredible. Okay, Catherine, so what was your defining moment, or did you have one?
I don't think I had a breakthrough, or it hasn't happened yet, I think. But I first kind of started publishing. I was working as a wetlands consultant, so I also got my undergraduate degree in environmental science, although I still wanted to write, and I asked some published writers, you know, how to get started. And the advice that I got was, if you want to write, just write and to start small. And so I started writing for the Association of Massachusetts Wetland Scientists newsletter, which was a printed like 8 to 10 page pamphlet, came out about monthly, I think. And I wrote articles about the Clean Water Act and wetland delineation and putting signs at stream crossings and things that I was encountering in my professional work.
Wow. Hey, and then you saw yourself in print and said, I guess I am a writer.
I think it was more that then I had clips to show other people that I was a writer, right? Sure. So I knew that I was a writer, but once you're sort of published and you have that byline, then you can use it to get, those I was volunteering, right? I was writing that for free, but then that helped me procure professional jobs later because I could show that I had experience working at doing science writing, which I, you know, which is what I do now professionally. And so those clips kind of helped grow and helped lead to the next thing.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. Sunday, April 19th at 3 o'clock p.m., the Bangor Band presents its annual Members Memorial Concert in Peaks Concert Hall at Bangor High School. This year, the band honors percussionist, longtime band member, and living legend Billy Miller. Admission is free. For more information, visit bangorband.org. On Thursday, April 23rd, the Blue Hill Library will host Writing Buddies, Linda Buckmaster and Elizabeth Garber in conversation at the library from 7 to 8 p.m. For more information, call the Blue Hill Library at 207-374-5515. On Sunday, May 3rd, the Circus of Finance comes to the Belfast American Legion Post No. 43 from 3 to 5 p.m. This comedy by local playwright Lisa Leverton features citizens negotiating leaps of economic daring. The staged reading of this new play will be followed by a panel and community discussion. Whose economy? Community initiatives for autonomy and stability. Refreshments will be served. For more information, visit https://inquire-within.com. For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org, and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the community calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org and list Creative Maine in the subject line. You are listening to Creative Maine on WERU 89.9 FM and on WERU.org. Now we return to our panel of writers. That leads us to our next topic of discussion, which is about your publishing experiences. And I know that, you know, you hear the stories about the people, they get 98 rejection letters and then one comes, you know, but this is a little different. It's a you had a slightly different gateway, I guess you could say. So what were some of your pathway to publication in other venues other than in your, you know, associated with your job? How did that work for you?
I think that happened after I came to Maine. I was a graduate student in science and I was writing more essay, right? So I think this is when I started writing more creatively and trying to submit essays. So getting a lot of those rejections. And I had an essay about Acadia was, I think, the first thing I had. First piece I had published. So, and a personal essay written in the first person. And that was published in Friends of Acadia Journal. So still not paid, but again, in print, right? Showing that I could do it, that what I was writing was worth publishing. And then I was kind of going the journalism angle. And so I also pitched, right, some stories to the Maine Commons, which was a newspaper published by Maine Independent Media and Maine Indie Media. And so they had kind of an alternative newspaper. And I did some stories, kind of more investigative pieces about pollution and some pollution associated with paper mills and the Penobscot River, and as well as the military base in Bangor. And those clips then got me into getting paid. Those clips got me jobs writing for Northern Sky News, which was a newspaper published by Murray Carpenter out of Belfast. And he started that around 2002, 2003. And so I started writing for him early on and getting paid for it. And that really sort of, I think, launched the career. I wrote a lot of stories from all over the New England region for Northern Sky News.
Interesting. Well, now two of you have your own imprints, so you don't have to wait for rejection letters. Mm-hmm. You know, you accept your own writing and publish
it. Actually, three of us do. I have an imprint too.
What's your imprint, Linda?
Huntress Press. I live on Huntress Avenue. And I did some independent publishing, which is sort of what Elizabeth was representing there. And I had in the back of my mind, I just called it Huntress Press. And finally, I made it, I won't say legal because I didn't do anything legal, but I have a little tagline, and I also have an image that was designed for me and it's on the back of the cover of my latest book has the little imprint. Yeah, so, you know, the independent publish thing is when, you know, what we might have been called personal publishing or whatever, but it's become a wide, wide scene because there's so, first of all, the publishing industry has a lot of issues, but there's so much interesting stuff being done. And people say, you know what, I want to do this. I'm not going to send out 50 queries and wait for something to happen for me. And my book before this one, Elemental, A Miscellany of Salt Cod and Islands, which is a hybrid of fiction, poetry, and nonfiction based on travels, with it's highly designed by Lori Harley in Portland, who I'd like to give a shout out to. And with lots of, we have maps and we have timelines and we have all this kind of stuff. And I just knew nobody's going to publish this. I sent out just the text in a couple of places and it got rejected. But I had a vision of the book that I wanted to create. And so I decided to do that one myself with Huntress Press and worked very closely with the designer over 4 months, probably during the pandemic, to pull that off. So there's a lot more we could say about that because a lot of us have experience with that one way or the other. But that's sort of one of my stories that I've done.
Well, again, it's genre defying. It's not one thing or the other. Shanna or Elizabeth or Catherine, what do you think of that whole, well, I want to do it, so I'm just going to do it myself and it doesn't matter where it fits on the shelf?
Rejection is part of a writer's life. Right. So hopefully we all get used to it as time goes on. When you're first starting out as a writer, you take it very personally and it hurts and it can be discouraging. But one thing for me is that because I worked in publishing and I worked as an editor on the college literary magazine, being in the editorial seat, seeing all the wonderful things that come in that we don't have room for, or that don't quite fit the theme, or that are simply too long, or are very similar to a piece we ran in the last issue. There are a lot of reasons that things get rejected that don't have anything to do with the quality of the writing and don't mean anything about that writer's talent or that piece's appeal. So that is super helpful to learn. And as you know, a lot of us have published other people. You sort of become detached from that kind of process. Because I do run the press, but I don't really publish myself. It's primarily to publish other people. So I do still go through the process. My last two books were published by Black Square Editions, which is based in New York, and Black Lawrence Press. I know all the publishers have Black in their name. And the Black Lawrence Press did the book of poems. And I had another book. My first book of poems was published by a little small press that came and went very quickly called Winnow Press. They didn't last very long. That was a first book award kind of situation, which was just sort of, back in the day, we were all doing that, sending the books out for these first book publication awards. Not the greatest system. And it also turns out not sustainable for the presses. That's why most of them are gone now, because there wasn't truly a connection between the books that were being chosen and the press developing its own voice and personality, which I think is why some of us now, also the fact that all of us are sort of hybrid writers, or you don't know where to shelve us. That's also probably why we end up doing small presses, which are much more flexible about that kind of thing than what I call industrial publishing. So it's not an accident that people like us who write these sort of hybrid things or have multiple interests coming into one book, have visual work as well as verbal work, find these kind of alternate routes. Like we flow where it's easier to flow, you know, for the kind of river we are. Thanks for it's a metaphor. We're all poets, right? So it's one of those things that, you know, there's a place in the writing life, in the writing world, and potentially the options available to us all now as for publishing, for most any kind of writing. You just have to sort of look around, and if you don't see the appropriate place for yourself, you can make it. So I think that's why we all have that in common.
Elizabeth, what do you think?
With my books of poetry, I wanted to create, I wanted to have a lot of control over the design of the book. And I did the, with all three of them, I designed them and worked with a designer and painters and brought them out by myself. But when I came out with, when I had a 350-page memoir about modern architecture and my childhood in Cincinnati, I wanted to have a publisher. And I was coming out of grad school, and I actually had a New York agent who, she and I worked really hard on the book, and she pitched it for about a year and didn't, it was like the publishing world was really changing. And if you weren't known, and I was writing a lot about my father, who was famous in the Midwest as an architect, but not enough on a national scale. So it wasn't picked up. And I was like, what am I going to do? And I was sort of stuck. And I was at a friend of mine's funeral who was a writer. And I thought her book was lost on her computer with her dying. And I thought, I want to make sure this book comes out. And so I heard about She Writes Press, which is an award-winning hybrid press in California that brings out a lot of women's books. And they're rigorous about who they choose. And it's sort of like a grad school course, I think of it. You learn how to bring out a professional, really professional, fantastically designed book. You work with them and you put skin in the game. You put money towards the design and the printing, and you decide how many are printed. And I also decided I wanted my book to come out in ebook. I also arranged and paid for the book to be recorded as an audiobook because I love audiobooks. And I wanted it available that way. And I also, that would be a way to have it available for international readers. So I brought out the book with She Writes Press. And I also worked with, they want people to have a publicist and really do bring their books out and have a tour. I created a book tour, and I went to Cincinnati a couple of times, and I spoke at the university, and I spoke on NPR, and spoke at a couple of libraries, and had a real success bringing a book out. For a small writer or a small town Maine writer, I sold 1,600 copies in all the different, combining the three different formats. And that felt like, there's a way that as a writer, it's like, what's enough in terms of enough for the book to be brought out? And I wanted to connect with the architecture world. And what was most thrilling was Architectural Record, was this architectural magazine that I remember my dad always reading. There was a fantastic review in Architectural Record. And it was like that, and the tour and giving the talks and becoming seen as an architectural historian of my dad's work, all that put together. And that was an extraordinary experience.
And you can say, I've arrived.
I arrived. That was enough. And then when I brought out the book about sailing on the Square Rigger, it was at the end of COVID, and it was a lot slower presentation. But I learned how to do book releases on Zoom and give talks where the talks were on Zoom, and had friends who had been on the ship who live all over the world. They were Zooming in to my book talks, and that was a thrill. So it was like, for each book, figuring out what's the right way to make sure that I brought that story out. And those were both really exciting.
Now, I have before me four women with a huge wealth of experience. Now that I listen to you, you know, you've each had your publishing experiences and your writing experiences and the life experiences that led to what you write. So when you go out and do events, now I see that on the 23rd of April, Linda and Elizabeth, you're going to be in conversation at the Blue Hill Library. So are you giving tips and hints to nascent writers? What are you discussing? How do you go about bequesting your experience to others?
Well, I think that we're going to be kind of doing a deeper talk about some of these issues for the people, you know, because it'll just be the two of us. We'll be talking more about how we did this, how we did some of the other things in our community work, you know, a do-it-yourself retreats we've done and how we did that. So we'll be sort of deepening and offering people who are writers themselves or want to be writers or who are readers and want to understand like how this process really gets done. And we find that people are really interested in hearing the processes of all this kind of stuff. So because we've been writing buddies, as we call ourselves, for probably about 15 years, we have a lot of shared experience, even though we're writing different kinds of things. I would say that we're not necessarily influencing heavily what each other writes because we have different concerns and topics and whatnot, but we're supporting those as the person goes along. And I'll just say, I know that we both and many of the other people here have done the same kind of thing. Shannon talked about it in developing other people or giving other people permission. And just through example of here we are, just plain old people, we're going to plant our peas and we're doing this kind of experience and we're creative in it. And I think that's a gift to people, and that's what they want to hear. So we did it at Anodyne, a great little bookstore in Searsport. Mm-hmm. We're going to do it at the Blue Hill Library with the help of Blue Hill Books, which will be there selling books. And so that's one of the kinds of things that we've done in terms of community building.
Well, I find that very interesting that you say giving people permission. I find that very forward-looking, actually. You're giving everybody permission to write. You don't,
right.
You know, I think, Catherine, tell me if I'm wrong, but when you start out as an academic author, as many of us have, you know, I've written a gazillion papers, you know, and I had a master's thesis and all of this. It's a very particular kind of writing that doesn't always translate well into other forms of writing. So when you go to people who maybe have had that experience and they're, quote, good writers in that format, what do you tell them? How do you say, well, you know, let some of your creativity flow? How does that work?
Well, I do that, right? I work with a lot of scientists to help them sort of communicate their research. And if you're a good academic writer, you can be a good public writer, right? For non-academics. And it's usually just a matter of restructuring. So a lot of times the personal connection or emotional connection is absent from academic writing. And so the first step is to pull that back in. And also the structure of academic papers is often, right? They have the introduction, this sort of what are the really broad relevance of your work. And it takes a while to get to like one of the things that I'm always scanning for is, well, where did this study take place? Like, where is it based? The sort of specificity of place and time and sort of what were the methods and who wrote it, right? So before you even get to the text. So all of those things. So a lot of times it's sort of like helping an academic just reorient and frame things. And you know, in journalism, there's the inverted pyramid where you put the most important information first for people that won't continue reading, right? The TLDR. Mm-hmm. And whereas in academic publishing, you've got to go all the way to the end to get the conclusion. So it's just helping people kind of reorient structure, I think, a lot of times. And also giving them, so I do a lot of workshops and trainings for scientists and for science students. And really, the greatest value of those is just creating space to have these conversations and creating time and dedicated time and space for them to think about what is the story that I want to tell and why, and who is my audience. I mean, we've heard from everyone today just about they knew who their audience was. They knew who they wanted to reach with a book. They had sort of that vision in mind, and that's really
interesting. Shanna, do you do a lot of community building and community encouragement with writing and art, maybe?
I have done both. I'm in the visual arts world. I'm the website administrator for the Union of Maine Visual Artists, and that entails working on all the calls for submissions. We just did a workshop last weekend with our local chapter at the Belfast Library about how to write artist statements, and myself and another artist who also has an MFA in creative writing. There are multiple of us. We sort of led the discussion on how to present yourself in that kind of context for people who are primarily visual, like how to bring that out in your own words for, you know, to share with galleries and jurists and stuff like that as you're making your art submissions. So that's one way. Another way would be, I've done several book fairs as Bloof Books, my publisher, my press. I did one at Colby College a couple of times called the Elm City Small Press Fest. And I've done one in a few other places. There's one at the Camden Poetry Festival. I haven't done that one. I did one in Portland at the Congress Square Market. I think I actually met Linda at the Belfast Art Market, where y'all had a tent where you were selling your books, and right. I had art and right. books. And right. so that's where we met several years ago now. So bringing the sort of books to the community that way. And at the Belfast Poetry Festival year before last, I set up an exhibition of chapbooks and zines, which are these stapled or hand-sewn little small, typically self-published or very, very small press. I wanted to bring those to the poetry audience at the Belfast Poetry Festival in a way that they maybe hadn't seen before. And I literally brought hundreds of these things and put them out on display for the weekend of the festival. And people could come and look at the more precious ones were in a display case, so people couldn't handle them. But a lot of them I left out. And, you know, people could just come and browse between the events of the poetry festival and see kind of what people make with their own writing. And I think that unlocks permission for a lot of people to see. It doesn't have to be a professionally published book. You can, you know, you can paint a cover, you can make a lino cut print, you can staple it, you can sew it. And, you know, you can use photocopies inside that. It's still a book and you're still presenting it. And like Elizabeth talked about, wanting control over that presentation, the visual sort of language of it, and every aspect of it being creative. And I think that that kind of presentation of the chapbooks and zines and letting people interact with them over the weekend, I hope introduced people to who weren't familiar with that concept. There's not a big zine collection in Maine that I know of. I could be wrong at any of the colleges or libraries that I'm aware of. So I would like to do that more. And I would also like to teach more workshops in making those things. I haven't done that yet in Maine, but I do it frequently in the past.
So what do we have coming up? I know I just mentioned on April 23rd from 7 to 8:30, the Writing Buddies, Linda and Elizabeth, will be at the Blue Hill Library from 7 to 8:30, it says. What else is coming up for you severally and collectively?
I have a book launch event coming up on May 21st. That's a Thursday at 5:30 at Jessup Memorial Library in Bar Harbor. And that is for my new book, Trees of Acadia, The Past, Present, and Future of Park Forests.
Wow.
So that will be the book launch and celebration on May 21st.
Excellent. Cool. Excellent. Yay. Congratulations. That's a big deal.
So I guess by the time this airs will be April. In the month of April, it's National Poetry Month. Yes. And myself and the poets of Bloof, my press, as well as poets all over the country now, do this thing called NaPoWriMo, which is National Poetry Writing Month, where we write a poem a day for the 30 days of April and generally post those public somewhere. So by the time this show airs, it will be happening on the Bloof blog. Myself and whoever wants to participate will be posting a draft a day. We don't always make every day. They're not always very good, but that's not the point. We write together daily and throw it out there. And it's just a way to sort of rev ourselves up again after winter. And we do that every April. And it's been for well over 20 years now. Wow. So that's a fun thing. And then I've got a couple of pieces in art exhibitions, but you know, nothing that's just me. So not worth really announcing. Mm-hmm.
So does anybody else have anything else before I wrap up here?
Dina, I can't remember if we mentioned the poetry festival in Camden. Did we mention that?
I'll mention it right now. Thursday through Saturday, May 14th through 16th, Camden Festival of Poetry at the Camden Congregational Church.
Great. Yeah.
Very good. And now if people want to find your books, where can they go? What's the Bloof blog? Where what's the URL for all that?
We are at bloofbooks.com.
B-L-O-O-F?
B-L-O-O-F, B-O-O-K-S. I like the double O's in both words.
Okay.
And I know everybody here has their books at Anodyne. That's everyone's favorite independent bookstore right now in our area, I think. So
Anodyne Bookstore in Searsport?
In Searsport.
And there they can find hard copies. Does anybody have online presence aside from Shanna?
LindaBuckmaster.com. You can order books directly from me, but you can also go to some of the bookstores up and down the coast, including Belfast's own Left Bank Books. So a couple of ways to get there.
Excellent. Elizabeth, how about you?
I also have a website, elizabethgarber.com, and you can order from me or Left Bank Books or Anodyne, or there'll be books at the Blue Hill at the Blue Hill Books.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Catherine, you've got your launch, but where can some of your other books be found?
You can find information about my books and all of my writing at katherineschmidt.com. And I also recommend that people use bookshop.org to order books online.
Ah, okay. Shanna?
Oh, I was just agreeing with the bookshop.org. That's an independent book press publishing thing.
Okay.
So it's great.
Well, thank you so much, all of you. This has been a very fun experience. I wish we had another hour. I have so many questions. Maybe we will, because at some point I want to have a discussion about audiobook versus hardcover book or, physical book and this sort of discussion, but we'll have to save that. But thank you so much. So my wonderful guests, Linda Buckmaster, Elizabeth Garber, Catherine Schmidt, and Shanna Compton, you all are an inspiration, and I'm so glad that you could join us on Creative Maine today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to my fascinating guests, Linda Buckmaster, Elizabeth Garber, Shanna Compton, and Catherine Schmidt. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on WERU.org for another eclectic episode on Thursday, May 21st at 4 p.m., when we will dive into the question, who are the folks in folk music? Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson, wishing you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.